Babe, I'm very pleased to report that I have been beavering through your many recent recommendations of late.
Well done.
I've seen American Fiction, loved it.
Did you go to cinema?
I did not. I watched it at home, but I enjoyed it very much all the same.
Do you think your only trips to the cinema have in fact been with me in the last 5 years?
Definitely in the last couple of years, yeah. I also ripped through One Day, as
very
most
good.
The rest of the country had been doing over the last week. And what I'm most interested in, quite frankly, is your opinion on Leo Woodall's, aka the character Dex's, signet ring.
Oh my God.
I saw a piece last week doing the rounds. I think it was a GQ piece, and it was arguing that Dex's signet ring is the new Connell's chain.
Are you trying to provoke me?
I am. Campus. I want to know your thoughts.
Okay, well, loyal listeners will know that I have a particular hatred of signet rings.
They're a big ick for you, aren't they?
Big ick. Saw far too many at Oxford, and it's always repelled me because they tended to be people that also wore like corduroys and red trousers. It was a certain type.
I'm indifferent to signet rings, but I would like you to try and just drill into that very specific stereotype because I want to picture him.
It's someone who laughs like this.
Sorry. Got it.
And calls everyone a legend.
Oh, okay.
When they bring around in.
Honeys, can you let us know, are signet rings a general ick or is this specific to Ellie?
No, I think some people find them really hot. However, and I did say this in the last episode we talked about this, where we also went into the history of the signet ring, which I now can't remember, but something to do with...
What episode was it? I can't even remember.
Oh God, we'll have to pop it in the show notes. But as I did caveat then as well, I do have a very lovely, fashionable friend who wears a signet ring, but she's female. Fun fact for you, Cathers, before I forget, quickly. Do you know who owns Connell's chain?
As in the Instagram account?
No, the actual chain.
Didn't Jay-Z Edgar Jones nick it from set?
Yes. You're one step ahead of me.
Fun fact there.
Oh, you took my fun fact away from me.
I'm sorry.
But that was the fact.
Yes, well, I did know that, but I'm sure the listeners will be fascinated nonetheless.
The Connell's chain was hot. I have to say, I really do love a man wearing a thin silver chain.
Yeah.
I made Isk get one.
Marlon has silver. He lost it recently after surgery when you have to take all your jewellery off. And now he's thinking that he's actually going to have to get a gold chain because he's going to have a gold wedding ring. So it's all going to need to match.
Oh, I love that. I'm not sure how I feel about a gold chain. But no, actually, I think he could look nice in it. I actually think it was Marlon who inspired me to buy a chain for Is.
Well, guys, let us know your thoughts on male jewellery.
Well, thank you, Cathers, for doing your homework. I would like to say that I also watched your recommendation of Brother's Son.
Yay!
Really liked it.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Loved the fact that it opened with the main guy doing his watching Bake Off and doing his baking, but then the baking is really like abandoned. He stops baking.
In the whole show?
Yeah.
No, he doesn't. He still continues to bake.
Well, he becomes obsessed with the churros and stuff, but I felt like there was like 3 episodes without any baking whatsoever.
How dare they?
I really thought we were going to constantly watch him baking.
Yeah, okay, I don't know if it's an every episode kind of thing. But guys, if you haven't seen it, do watch Brother's Son on Netflix.
It features a great lead who kills and bakes with equal aptitude.
Exactly.
Guys, I'm so sorry. I'm a bit hungover and I think the madness
You need to do a disclosure.
Yes, I went to Coco last night.
We're recording on a Sunday morning, guys, FYI. Els is feeling fragile.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your night last night?
Had to have a Lucozade and a packet of crisps this morning as breakfast. It's the only time I will have ready salted. An abominable flavour.
Needed.
But necessary.
On a hangover.
Yeah, to settle the stomach.
How was Coco?
It was great. I love Coco. The new club is fucking gorgeous. Have you been?
No, I haven't. I keep hearing everyone hyping it though.
They've put so much money into it. I actually don't know if it's...
Were you in the members club bit or like the actual club bit?
We bought tickets for the club. It was Amapiano night.
Yeah.
But Is somehow managed to get us backstage into the members club.
Of course, he
has this like special superpower of just like befriending everyone on the door. And next thing you know, you've got 4 wristbands.
You're backstage.
On. Yeah.
Cute.
And it was lovely.
Do you remember going home? Did Is have to bundle you into bed?
I do remember. I took out my contact lenses.
Phew.
So that is
That's a good sign.
A huge...
Did you take makeup off?
Took my makeup off, put on my moisturiser.
Okay, that's not non-negotiable. Too bad. Yeah. I feel like the worst when you wake up in a face of makeup, you just feel like the most disgusting person on earth.
I haven't done that since my teen years. However, no.
Not, in God. The, I do it every so often.
in the cab, Issa was like, what the fuck are you doing? I took out a slice of bread that I had in my Sainsbury's bag that I'd actually packed for work to have for breakfast, and an entire jar of unopened peanut butter.
What, you'd brought to Coco?
Well, I'd brought it to work. So
what, and then you went straight from work to Coco?
So I made, So then I had peanut butter on this slice of bread in the cab.
Well,
and got
that
it
sounds
all over my trousers.
Very multitasking of
a 31-year-old.
Yeah, woman. Like something you would do.
Yes. Anyway, what did you do? Oh my gosh, you went and got registered to be married.
I did. That was actually last week. We did it on Valentine's Day because obviously, you know, as you well know, when you've been together 10 years, like, do you really give a shit about Valentine's Day? Like, no, but it's quite nice to do something to mark it, especially the year we're getting married. So we needed to go and do this like administrative task anyway of like giving notice of marriage. You have to do it with your local council.
Oh, so you, it's not like you... Right, okay, so you don't get married on paper?
No, you can't get married unless you've done this step.
Oh, I
see. So you have to give notice prior to your official wedding because it's actually based on a weird old-fashioned thing of literally a notice going up. I think it's like a throwback to when we were living a kind of village life where the town hall was the centre of every community and a sign goes up giving notice that will say like, Kathleen Johnston and Marlon Percy give notice to get married. And anyone that like disagrees can come in and challenge it, basically.
Oh my God, a rival suitor.
Well, I think more it would be if you were already married or if you were like breaking the law in some kind of way.
My imagination.
I don't think it's like the same as the moment where they're like, if anyone does has a reason that these two should not be married and someone like runs in and they're
I've been in love with you for years.
Yeah, I don't think you could go into like Lambeth Council and be like, I refuse to allow these people to get married because I would like to marry them. Like, I don't know.
I would love that to happen to me.
I mean, I don't know. We'll see. But it was actually really cute and it made it feel really real. Like,
do we know yet what you're going to do about your name?
We do. I'm not going to change it.
Well done.
Yeah. I mean, I have absolutely no qualms with women changing their name. I think, I tell you what, if I wasn't a journalist, like if my name wasn't relevant to my profession, and if Marlon's surname wasn't Percy, which doesn't go with Kathleen, then I would maybe consider it. Like if Marlon had a better surname than me and I thought it would like make my name sound nicer, I probably would consider it. But for those two reasons, that professionally it doesn't make sense and also it doesn't actually go that well, I'm just like, no, I won't.
Whereas Marlon Johnston has a certain gravitas to it.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be taking my name either, unfortunately. But I'm not opposed to... I mean, I did think at one point, I was like, should we double barrel it? As in, not for him, because just, again, absolutely no diss to anyone else, but I would just personally never like expect a man to take my name. I wouldn't want them to expect me to take theirs either. I think I'm for everyone having their own identity and going by whatever name they like. But Kathleen Johnston Percy, as my mum said, sounds like a solicitor's.
Yes, it does.
Or
it
like
really
a financial
does.
Planner's or Johnston Percy. Like,
or
no.
A funeral parlour.
Yeah.
So. I have a friend who have just done a double barrel, but without
and
a hyphen.
The man has too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
so
it works
they take
really
on
well.
The same name.
I think it also depends on like the syllables. It's like their surname's essentially the same length.
Oh, so it works nicely and snappily.
And quite like they have lots of vowels in, it kind of works. I would
but then
say
I do
it,
but... have friends. The only thing is, so one of my friends has a double vowel surname and she had a little girl. They chose not to give her a double vowel surname. They just gave her her dad's surname because my friend, having grown up with a double vowel surname, was like, I wouldn't want to flip that on my kid.
Because
like, it was actually really annoying. It's just like everyone refers to you by like the secondary surname anyway. It just is kind of complicated and a bit long-winded and yeah.
And also, do you put a dash in the email? That's always
that's Ellie's biggest worry.
Because one of my colleagues, I always have to email.
I usually thought when people get married with their work emails, it will be like something ne or ni. I never know how you pronounce that again.
Ne.
N-E-E. Is that what it actually is French? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it has their old name. That's what I feel like people always do on their work emails.
No, I mean in the actual email address, like do you hyphenate the double barrel? Or do you? I think they removed
the really big questions about people taking each other's names in marriage. Not questioning the patriarchy, not looking at this tradition as inherently misogynistic, but the email signature.
The email
address, even.
So, unpopular opinion, which I'm saying because I'm feeling frisky on a hangover. If a man took the girl's name.
Yeah, I'm just not into that. Again,
is
I know
that's a red flag.
Well, it is for me, and I know that sounds insane. And there's probably so many people listening, like, you're literally being a massive sexist by saying that men shouldn't take women's names. It's not that that's like a blanket rule. There's just something about men taking women's names which gives me the ick. I can't lie.
That's exactly how
does.
I feel.
And I know that's wrong. I know that's objectively wrong. It's probably my internalized misogyny, but I don't like it.
I think it just gives the idea of someone who's desperate for everyone to know that they're a feminist.
Yeah, and it kind of is giving like insta-husband. Do you know what I mean? God. Like the men that take their wives' names is often that dynamic. So like, you know, in Generally. The Fro, Victoria McGrath, yeah. That really well-known fashion influencer, her husband took her name. And even though his name is Alex McGrath, his name prior was Alex Harrison, but everyone knew him as Harrison. He's one of those people who was always like, his nickname was his surname.
So now he's Harrison McGrath.
I guess, yeah.
So anyway, we still haven't started on any of our topics.
God. We haven't even got into the episode yet. Well, this is Straight Up, the pop culture podcast, as you all well know, hosted by us journalists Kathleen and Ellie.
Hello.
Right, first up today, I want to talk to you about the new rom-com, Anyone But You.
Oh, yes.
The eagerly anticipated Sydney Sweeney, Glenn Powell rom-com that we talked about on air about a year ago when there was a load of media coverage of their potential chemistry as co-stars.
Yes, and also recently we talked about how their savvy marketing of pretending, well, maybe not denying rumours that Sydney had cheated on her fiancé.
It all feels quite purposeful in terms of the marketing of the film. Like, yeah. There has been so much noise around this film, which is quite interesting, given that both the leads, while very well-known actors, and there's no denying that Sydney Sweeney is, like, having her huge moment, they're not A-list Hollywood tried and tested rom-com faces.
Correct.
So it's something a little bit new. It was interesting that Sony chose to put so much energy behind this film. Like, so much promo. It's been so heavily teased for a year.
Is the person who wrote it quite a well-known rom-com director?
Yeah, so the director is Will Gluck. His previous films include Friends with Benefits.
Right,
which
yes.
is that rom-com with Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake.
I loved that.
I quite liked that, but having looked online, doing a bit of research around this, a lot of other people hated it. It was cited an ill-fated rom-com and a bad pairing, putting Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis together. Will Gluck also did the Peter Rabbit movie recently.
Oh, can't say I've seen it.
Haven't seen it either. Sydney Sweeney is the exec producer on the film.
Go Sweeney.
Sydney.
Sorry.
Obviously, we love Sydney Sweeney. So that's why I was quite excited to see this film, because we really like her. She's obviously amazing in Euphoria. She's amazing in White Lotus. She's in Handmaid's Tale. She was in Reality recently. Am I missing anything else?
She's in the very badly reviewed new film, Madame Web.
Oh, that's getting really bad
reviews,
isn't it?
Absolutely sorted. I've just remembered a mortifying moment when I interviewed Sydney Sweeney last year for Euphoria. And you know when you interview someone and you get on really well with them and then they're telling you something that you really relate to. Yeah. And then you're like, I know I only have half an hour, but I have to tell them about how I relate to this.
Yeah, and then you're like cannibalising your actual time by whining on about yourself.
And then you suddenly realise that they yes. literally don't care.
Oh, it's
at
the worst.
All. And
it's
it was really embarrassing because she was talking about how hard it was when she was bullied at school for having big boobs and like being sexualised from a young age. And I was like, I also have really big boobs. And I just remember, and I literally told her my boob size.
She was blatantly like, okay.
What's wrong with me?
Thank you, random journalist, for your brass eyes. Thank you.
When I was transcribing it, I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's only when you transcribe. I had that recently. I was doing an artist bio.
On the phone.
And I was finding it so cringe where I was in any way bringing myself up. Do you know what I mean? I know you need to do that for a conversation, but I'm like, why am I mentioning what music I was listening to when I was 10?
Do you know what I do find really annoying about celebrities, though, is that they don't even pretend to care.
Sometimes they do, though, because remember when I interviewed Louis Theroux when he still had his magic touch, some might argue. However, it was when he started getting on the boring train, in fact, because it was when he was dropping that Scientology film. And when I interviewed him, he kept turning the interview around back onto me. And it was a really interesting dynamic because he would be like, and what did you think of that?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting that you say that. Why?
Yes, but so there are those people that do that I think are also performatively being curious to make them seem more interesting.
But Sydney Sweeney couldn't even muster a performative curiosity.
About my massive boobs. Knockers, yeah.
I mean, this is absolutely not the point, but my God, is her and Glenn Powell just like the typical cookie cutter blonde Hollywood rom-com?
They look related,
duo.
I'll say it.
They do a bit. But they're both so ridiculously conventionally attractive. You can't help but think that Will Gluck is playing with that. Like the camera will like linger over both their bodies and they're both wearing swimsuits a lot. I think one review I read basically made this jibe about how the budget for swimwear alone must have been bigger than the GDP for a small country.
Oh my God, that's great.
I personally actually really don't find Glenn Powell attractive.
No
shade to him. I actually was a little bit unaware of who he even is. I'm going to put it out there right now. Until this film, I was like, who on earth is Glenn Powell? Like, when all the rumours went crazy about the two of them getting together, when the pap shots from the shoot went viral, he was in Top Gun Maverick, which I haven't seen. Benjamin Lee for The Guardian's headline was, Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell make for a pretty yet pretty unconvincing couple in a glossy yet charmless rom-com, which I thought was kind of axe. So I really enjoyed it, but it's like incredibly forgettable and a bit stereotypical and a bit shit. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's bad, enjoyable, you know? Yes. It's like it's an objectively bad film, but you quite enjoy watching it.
It's like eating a McDonald's.
Exactly. And it's been very much billed as a rom-com with an edge. What's and you definitely edge? Can see that it's a bit different. So Moll and I actually felt weird about it because we couldn't tell if it was self-aware and trying to take the piss out of itself or whether it was actually oblivious to like the tropes and stereotypes of the genre of rom-com. You couldn't tell how much it was taking the piss. So Marlon thought it was giving kind of White Lotus, but I wonder whether he just thought that because it was Sydney Sweeney.
Yes,
I was like, you do realise it's the same actress.
Yeah.
He thinks it felt quite ironic and that it was like playing with the rom-com genre. But for me, it just didn't go far enough for that to actually be super convincing. Like the plot's actually kind of hard to follow. So would you like me to tell you what it's actually about?
No spoilers, please. Can you have a spoiler in a rom-com?
I mean, they get together at the end. So, despite having an amazing first date, Bea and Ben's initial attraction quickly turns sour. When they unexpectedly find themselves at a destination wedding in Australia, the pair pretend to be the perfect couple to keep up appearances.
Why are all rom-coms based around destination weddings these days?
I know it's, again, a real trope of the genre, so surely they must have kind of done that on purpose. What I did find a little bit flimsy, and I have to say I agree with the Guardian reviewer, Benjamin Lee, is I couldn't quite tell why they weren't together in the first place. So they have this one-night stand, and then they decide very quickly that they hate each other.
Yeah.
Again, this isn't a spoiler. This is right at the beginning of the film. But they don't really make a convincing case for why it is that despite them having amazing chemistry and a wonderful night together, they then decide they hate each other because of a small miscommunication. You know how these like little miscommunications always end up being like the massive like plot drivers?
Yeah.
In these kind of basic stories. What's quite interesting is it's loosely based on Much Ado About Nothing.
Gosh, which I did not know watching it.
And I literally studied Much Ado About Nothing at A-level, so. And it's obvious that the film is trying to kind of do the typical rom-com thing, you know, like the Shakespeare nostalgia of films like Clueless and Get Over It and 10 Things I Hate About You. You know how they're all like rough reinterpretations of Shakespearean tales.
Much Ado About Nothing, is that when they're all swapping partners?
Beatrice and Benedict.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, oh yeah, oh, I've just clocked their B and Ben. So that's obviously what they're going, like she's Beatrice and he, I guess, must be a Benedict or a Benjamin. Who knows? I can't remember. But I really liked one particular Empire review, which I thought really summed it up quite well. So Empire wrote, if there's a brightness to this film, it's found in its two leads. Rising stars Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell are officially two of the human race's most beautiful representatives, both dripping with confidence and charisma, both destined to become giant A-listers if they aren't already. So the Empire review said that the film feels very skin deep, which I really agree with. They said Powell's character Ben is described as a gorgeous idiot at one point, a rare bit of self-awareness for the film as a whole. This is all just a glossy bit of nothing. The film valiantly attempts to give both leads some klutzy physical drama to temper their unrealistic standards of beauty. Sweeney engages in some Mr. Bean-style crotch drying. Powell swims like a nervous six-year-old. Yeah, crotch drying, like, i.e. like the tap splashes water on her jeans and they make this whole like slapstick scene out of her trying to dry this wet patch on her jeans.
Oh
while he's
God.
Waiting outside. Like, it just feels pretty unoriginal and not that funny.
Yeah.
Not going to lie, it's not funny. It's one of those films, you know what I mean? Like, it's an enjoyable watch. The aesthetics are lovely. The
but
house in Australia
laugh.
That it's all set in, but no, it's quite unfunny.
And what is the chemistry like between Sydney
yes,
and
Glenn?
Yes,
so this was actually why I wanted to watch it. That's why I was most interested in.
Do we think they're banging?
I don't know.
For real.
Do you know what? I did find their chemistry convincing, but I wouldn't say it was, like, off the charts. There's other examples of chemistry that we've discussed recently on air that I think are far more powerful. It didn't sizzle for me. It felt a little bit like flat. I don't
okay.
know. Not completely unconvincing, as I said, but definitely not, wow, it is so obvious that these two are banging behind the scenes.
Basically, what you're saying is if they weren't hot, it would be one of the shittest films ever.
No, but yes. Like, it's one of these really hard ones to describe because it's not. There's objectively way more shit films. For example, Watch It on the Sofa as a hangover slob.
Yes.
Rather than it being the kind of film that you would plan an entire date night around.
It's not event cinema. No.
Absolutely not.
Okay, good. This is the kind of
hard-hitting journalism we really need. And one thing I'd like to say about it,
oh yes,
is that Natasha Bedingfield's Unwritten, it plays very heavily in the film. No, what was that? Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the world that you cannot find. Reach out for something that long distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions.
I keep thinking Kathleen's going to stop, but she's not.
Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you. Only you can let it in.
No one else. No one else can
something. Anyway, obviously that song was iconic when we were growing up. It was the theme tune for The Hills.
Yes, I loved it. What was her other song?
I mean, Unwritten was her big hit. There's no two ways about that.
Was she related to Daniel
Yes,
Bedingfield?
Yes, she is the sister of Daniel Bedingfield. And anyway, everyone else has probably noticed that Unwritten has been having a huge moment on social media. It has gone everywhere. It's really viral. Natasha Bedingfield's been like, oh my God, I can't believe this song that I wrote in my 20s when I'm now in my 40s is like having this whole moment. It's literally just like Sophie Ellis-Bextor and Murder on the Dance Floor post Saltburn.
Yes.
Suddenly a whole new generation are discovering these like iconic noughties bangers.
And not noughties, but Kate Bush and Stranger Things.
Yeah, exactly. So it's giving kind of new life to older songs for a generation that weren't there, I guess, the first time. I saw quite a good piece that was doing the rounds. Again, I have full disclosure, I didn't read it, but the headline, I was like, that is bang on, which was...
It's all you need these days. Yeah,
how the UK Hun pop star took over the movies. And I was that is actually very apt.
The UK Hun pop
the
star.
The UK Huns. Very, very apt.
That is great.
But yeah, the song figures very heavily in the film. So it's his comfort song. The song is used to humanize him. And then there's this entire number at the end when the credits roll. Sorry for the spoiler, but I think you can go over this one.
Yes.
Where the entire cast like sing the song.
What?
So the song is very much entrenched.
So they all do a singing number at the end?
Yeah. So it'll flick to different scenes of different cast members like singing it. So going through the whole song.
I have to say, Kathers, you have never so completely put me off watching a film.
Have I not?
No.
Oh no, sorry.
It sounds absolutely awful. The fact that it has musical theatre at the end was the nail in the coffin.
It's like as the credits roll, do you know what I mean? It's meant to be a sort of bloopery, funny, silly thing at the end.
I'm very glad I've heard your entertaining review.
Good. And because you will not be
I will not be watching it. But if anyone else has seen it, do let us know.
Yeah, and if Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell do get together, then you know I'll take my hat off to them. But
so her fiance,
who is her fiance?
I think he's a businessman.
She never talks about it, does she? I saw she was on the cover of Glamour or something recently, and she'll always like politely decline to ever discuss her relationship.
Sydney Sweeney, I sometimes worry about her being too sort of controlled. You know, she doesn't drink alcohol or drink coffee.
Oh, really? Controlled by who?
Sorry, herself.
Oh,
I just feel like she's
like by the shadowy forces of Hollywood.
By Jennifer Lopez. Yes. Only because she also doesn't drink coffee.
Yeah. Oh, right. I was so like, wait, why? Why would Jennifer Lopez be controlling Sydney Sweeney? I'm so confused.
I love how you laughed anyway.
I thought it was a weird reference to our episode last week because I was like, well, fair, we did cover J-Lo, but I'm just going to let her run with this one.
Literally, there's tequila seeping out of my veins. So her fiancé is Jonathan Davino or Davino. Oh, she said that she opened up in her Glamour interview about hearing false stories about her fiancé. Has he also been accused of stuff?
Oh.
Of the rumour that Davino, 38, is a restaurateur.
What?
That's the rumour.
Of the rumour that he's a restaurateur, she denies it. No, that can't be the rumour.
Sweeney told the magazine that is not only untrue, but she has no idea where that came from.
Wait, why is that an allegation that needs to be covered? I'm so confused.
He's also not the heir of a pizza company. He's a business guy from Chicago.
Right.
And we've been watching this narrative for 6 years now, and I'm like, what the hell?
How old is she?
I think she's 26.
Right, Hans, who else here feels inexplicably overwhelmed by a silent rage at the sound of somebody loudly crunching on crisps at their desk?
Or heavy breathing like a wounded wildebeest.
Oh, or snivelling incessantly on the tube.
Or clacking their acrylic nails on a keyboard.
Ah!
I mean, we could go on, couldn't we, babe? But no, you are not a psychopath. If common sounds make you feel suddenly furious, you might just have something called misophonia.
Yeah, so to explain, guys, our ears are shaped like shells, so the sound we receive is actually always distorted about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out, but if you're like Els and I, then you're going to need a bit of a helping hand, and you have to get yourself a pair of Karma earbuds from our absolute faves at Flare Audio.
They have stopped severe bouts of violence. They are so tiny, comfy, and super unobtrusive. Much better than noise-cancelling headphones, which shut you off from sounds you actually need to hear. And don't just take our word for it. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch in lockdown.
Yeah, and even if you don't have misophonia, they can help with so many annoying and sharp sounds to just take the edge off, help keep you calm. You know, if you're working in a cafe, something like that, you've got to head to Flare Audio to get your pair now for $19.95.
Thank you to Flare. Talking of glamour interviews.
Yeah.
Emrata was on the cover looking absolutely amazing, I have to say.
I mean, when is she not?
Oh, I know. But it was particularly hot. She's definitely had her lips done because they keep growing.
Interesting. They look good though. I'll have to go away and do some sleuthing after this. I can't comment either way.
No, but do go and have a look. And the interview is relatively what you'd expect. But the quote that interested me the most was about how she debunks the idea that people don't dress for men. So have you seen recently she's been kind of leaning into her like, I'm just going to post a naked selfie because this is what you expect of me and therefore it's ironic.
Yes.
Basically she's been kind of like...
And she does lots of sultry TikToks.
Yes.
And it all does feel quite ironic. Maybe she wants to continue to push the conversation around different types of feminism as she started in her collection of essays, My Body.
Yes, which were good. Okay, so she says in the interview that I found interesting, talking about how she's posting all these pictures at the moment of her looking super hot and kind of leaning into the like, yes, I can be a hot bimbo when I want to be and what. She says, so if I'm in a certain type of mood where I want to post something or wear something that I could be judged for because it's quote unquote desperate, I'm a little bit like, well, that's where I'm at. I've learned to prioritize my own happiness, probably because of my son. I feel I have a bigger fish to fry than caring about the politics of whether or not I'm appealing to the male gaze in a given moment. Then she says, because I know there are plenty of times when I don't and I'm just living my life and it feels great. There's this huge conversation happening with Gen Z or the Taylor Swift lyric, I don't dress for women, I don't dress for men, I dress for revenge. Then she says, who do you dress for? The female gaze, the male gaze? I feel like everybody's bullshitting when they say, oh no, I'm doing this for the girlies. Which I actually really agree.
I do as
who
well.
Who are we kidding? We are not dressing for the girlies.
I don't know. I'm torn because I think you're right. Like, I think the male gaze has become so deeply entrenched in how we even perceive ourselves as women. Like, it's that internalized patriarchal kind of view is so endemic to all culture that we consume from when we're younger, in that we accidentally, I think, internalize the male gaze without even realizing we're doing it.
Our self-worth is so refracted through the male gaze.
But I do definitely also think that there is room for women dressing for the girlies, and I think some women do, and I think it's really obvious when you look at even how certain people dress. Like, there are certain looks and outfits that men just never like, whether that's cardigans or something frumpy or something with loads of frills on it. They
big
don't
sleeves.
Like the bows in hairs. There's certain things that all men generally, unless they're really trendy, seem
you're right.
to kind of find a bit much. I don't know, it's so, men are so basic, no offense to any of our male listeners, but when it's like, you know most men will be, oh, I like that bodycon dress, and I don't like the big puffy sleeved kind of maiden look.
Yes.
You know, there's always a similarity in what they like, and it's usually about how it shows the body,
absolutely,
that kind of thing. And I definitely think there's a huge uptick in women dressing in stuff that doesn't pander to the sexualization of their bodies.
Yes, I agree with you. I retract my previous statement because actually thinking about it, I do have quite a few, my fashion conscious friends probably do dress for the girlies, or rather themselves.
Yeah, and I actually highly rate women that dress for the girlies because I think it's such a good like, fuck you to patriarchal norms. And actually, a woman rating your outfit is worth 10 times a man rating it. Like, if I am wearing something and loads of women tell me I look good, that means so much more to me than men telling me I look good. Like, I actually think dressing for the girlies is testament to genuine interest in fashion rather than just trying to make yourself look appealing.
Yes.
Like, it's actually about the art and integrity of clothing more.
Yes. I suppose what's important is to acknowledge that also people do dress for the male gaze. And I think there's sometimes, maybe on TikTok, on Instagram, a certain kind of celeb that will be like, for the girlies, when it's quite clearly that you are very much presenting yourself for the male gaze. But there's nothing wrong with that necessarily. Maybe the issue is we shouldn't demonize it.
Well, as Emrata says herself, I think it's a generational thing. Like, my sister, who's just turned 18, the kind of clothing that she wears is unapologetically non-sexual.
Yes.
And often. She does have lots of little baby doll dresses and things like that, but she also has, like for example, my 18-year-old sister will often wear my dad's shorts. When I was 18, I wouldn't have been seen fucking dead in my dad's shorts. I wouldn't wear my dad's shorts now. Do you know what I mean? Like, big jokes, like, can shitty shorts, like, to her knees. You know, she would never have any qualms about having, like, hairy armpits, even in front of our family, which it sounds ridiculous, I know, because it's absolutely not radical to have hairy armpits in this day and age. But when I was her age, I would have been embarrassed even in front of my own dad and brothers to have hairy armpits. Which speaks to the how much we were internalizing the male gaze on every level. Whereas my sister doesn't give a shit. My brother might say to her on holiday once, he was like, "Oh, hairy armpits." She was like, "Yeah, and like she doesn't see it as a slight or embarrassing." Whereas I would have taken that on as like, "Oh my god, they've just said I have hairy armpits." When I was 18, now I'd be able to be unapologetic about it and be like, "Yeah."
I think I really do dress the male gaze, but that's also partly because my body shape really doesn't suit anything for the girlies.
Yeah.
Blouses, shirts, t-shirts, frills.
Yeah, you are more of like a bodycon hun because of your body type.
Yeah.
Because that's what looks most flattering on you. But I wonder whether that's because, like I have just said, it's a generational thing. And that's because our generation is still very much trying to dress in a way that is like sexually appealing. Whereas younger generations aren't.
Yes, exactly.
It goes back to that very kind of problematic labelling, doesn't it? Of like girl pretty and boy pretty.
Yes.
Which I think has been having a bit of a cultural moment, like people have been, there's a discourse around it.
Yes, so it made me think of this viral piece by Michaela Jameson on body on her Substack Body Type called "I Dress Sexy for Other People and So Do You." And she says, "Sometimes women proclaim that we only wear anything because we like it and that other people's attention plays no role. When it comes to dressing sexy, I think we feel compelled to do this because it seems a more correct feminist and intellectual motivation and because we've taught to hide the work of desirability and beauty in general." And she kind of opens up in the piece to comments and ask lots of people what they think. And I really loved the response from Jessica DeFino, who I mention a lot on this.
Yes, the beauty self-stuff.
Yes, the unpublishable, obsessed with her. And she had quite an interesting response. She says basically there should be no shame in dressing for other people, be that the male gaze or anyone's gaze, because if we position fashion beauty as a form of expression and communication, it must inherently involve another, someone or something we are communicating to.
Yes, I so agree with that. Yeah. Fashion is in itself a projection. If you were on your own all the time, you wouldn't give a shit about what you were wearing because it's not signifying anything to anyone else.
Exactly. And I guess maybe this is what when everyone's like, "Oh, I'm literally just dressing for me." It's like, but you're not wearing that at home.
If I was dressing for literally just me, I'd be wearing the most comfortable and ugly clothing all the time because comfort would be the only factor that would matter.
Yes.
The actual look of it would be irrelevant.
You are surely dressing, you're dressing for you in the sense that how it makes you feel by others looking, the response you get from others looking at you.
It's you take your sense of self from how other people are perceiving what you're wearing.
And I think there is something just ridiculous about saying that that's not true.
This actually makes me think of something I said when we were talking about The Idol, the weekend HBO show, and I said that Lily Rose Depp's wardrobe in that film was ridiculous and so clearly very kind of skimpy and sexualized because of the way in which the series objectified her. But then actually, I had to eat my own words after, because eat your own words, is that even the right phrase?
Eat your hat.
Eat my hat, swallow my words, whatever. Because I saw pictures of her out with her girlfriend and they were pap shots and she was wearing just as skimpy clothing as she does in the show. So I was like, wow, I'm completely wrong. So
yeah,
I was full of crap. Actually, they're clothes she likes wearing and feels comfortable in at all times. That's not just her being sexualized as a pop star on the show.
Although, as a famous person, maybe she has been sexualized.
And actually, if you know that pap shots are being taken of you at any given time, you would always be aware of what you're wearing.
That's true.
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know. Also a really good comment from Jessica DeFino. She says, "I really hate the modern Western view that everything we do should be purely individually motivated. We're communal creatures."
Really agree with that. Hard agree.
I do think that every time you step outside the house, you are communicating with others, whether you like it or not. I also do think that this time of being around 30, there is such a kind of focus on the last few years of your prime. And I'm feeling this more and more now, like maybe I should wear makeup to work because I've only got a few more years where it will look this good on me. Or like maybe I should always be dressing for the male gaze.
That's interesting.
Because soon I won't even get wolf whistles in the street anymore.
You can't think like that though.
I know, but that's how bad my internalized misogyny is. And in fact, someone commented on the Substack saying, "I think a lot about this ticking time clock that'll dictate when I'm no longer hot enough anymore, and realize that a lot of my supposedly empowering provocativeness was actually a mask to hide how scared I was about my lack of self-identity. When you buy into a cultural expectation of what womanhood should should be so holy that you refuse to cultivate or nurture your own self-image, it is easy and convenient to rebrand your aesthetic appearance as one that you're doing for yourself. Which I found very interesting.
I really agree with that again.
Oh, even Emerald Fennell recently saying that she was past her prime. She's 38. I found that such a profoundly depressing comment.
Yeah, see, I just don't know if I agree with that because there are so many women that are in the prime of their lives in their 40s and 50s now. When you look at the even celebrity sphere, whether it's J-Lo, like we were talking about last week, whether it's Kourtney Kardashian living her best life with her new baby and her new husband, like there's definitely a change in public perception in terms of when a woman's life is, and air quoting here, kind of like over.
I remember my friend telling us when we were 22, on her 22nd birthday, her dad said that she had now passed her prime.
I mean, that's just ridiculous. And her dad well, that is so problematic.
I know.
Weird.
I guess
you definitely internalised that.
Ooh, exactly. I remember feeling really depressed about it.
I know loads of women that are like in their early 40s and they're way hotter than people in their 20s. Just isn't about age.
I know. I think it's also because literally in terms of biology, at this age, we keep being told soon you're going to run out of time to have kids or whatever. So there is a sense of being past your physical prime in terms of womanhood.
See, I would say I've actually gone the other way in that I'm more comfortable dressing for the girlies now than I ever was. I'm more empowered to wear things that I know men might not objectively like because I don't care anymore, whereas I used to. Like literally the other day I kept a top. I'd ordered some stuff online and there was a top that he didn't particularly like. And I was like, don't care. I think it's really nice. I'm keeping it. Whereas about 5 years ago, I might have actually listened to what he was saying.
Yeah, interesting.
And I'm much more comfortable wearing blazers and baggy trousers and oversized jumpers and t-shirts. And like, I actually love wearing like masculine clothing that doesn't flatter the body at all now.
I actually did notice that when I was on the tube yesterday. I was looking at this group of young girls and they were so formlessly dressed. They looked so cool. I loved they looked amazing. But yeah, I was like, wow, you really can't see the shape of their bodies.
Yeah, I actually think it's kind of dated now to wear like super figure hugging stuff. I think it feels very like the noughts. You know what I mean? It feels very like Hervé Leger era.
Oh my God, I remember renting a Hervé Leger dress. But then Skims bodycon dresses... I've got two of them. So very inspirational from the Gen Zers.
The Alphas.
The Alphas. I saw that piece in the Times.
Oh, I wasn't even talking about that. That's just what the generation under Gen Z are called. What was the piece in the Times?
It was all about like what it's like, the Alpha generation. Who are they?
My main insight comes from my 18-year-old sister.
I was actually, I didn't even know until the Times piece that we called the Alphas. Is that wild?
Funnily enough, I was around at my sister's the other day.
Yeah.
And she was doing her art coursework. She's right in the middle of her A-levels. And her entire art project is about the male gaze. Like, you can just see how much more progressive this younger generation are. I never even heard the terminology, the male gaze, until I was at university.
Gosh, I don't know when I heard the term.
And it was coined by that female director.
Yeah. And I say all this, but of course, there is the shining beacon that is J-Lo, who is showing us that age definitely isn't just a number. I was actually Googling images of her last night. She looked fucking incredible at the premiere of her new film and album, This Is Me Now.
She really did.
I was like, how do you look like this? Her highlight. I need to know where she gets her highlighter, actually. She looks fantastic. But guys, we hope you enjoyed our J-Lo special last week.
Yeah.
And I have more thoughts because I've watched the film. And it is absolutely unhinged.
On Amazon Prime.
And my one takeaway is that I didn't realise how self-aware J-Lo is. Of all the things that we kind of mocked her for in the last episode, she knows all of this and more. So throughout the film, there's just so many funny jokes about she's just constantly taking the piss out of herself for having all these like husband.
Oh, I just love her.
I know.
I actually felt bad listening back to the episode. I thought I was too critical of her considering I've been such a lifelong stan.
I think it's good to have nuance.
Yes.
But so for instance, there's a really funny scene where she's doing another wedding and she throws her bouquet and someone in the crowd is like, don't catch it, it's cursed. And all the women like fan out. So it's to be like as far away from the bouquet as possible. And similarly, all those celebrity cameos that we were wondering about, like why the hell is Trevor Noah and Jane Fonda and Kim Petras in it? So Fat Joe plays her therapist, but Jane Fonda, Kim Petras, Post Malone, and Trevor Noah and Kiki Palmer and some others I'm sure I'm forgetting are like in heaven as part of the zodiacal council, and each of them represents a zodiac sign, and they are all there with their like gold telescopes looking down on Earth, being like, we sent her a Scorpio, we thought it would work, and like they've sent her all these men like according to which star signs they think would be compatible with her.
Is she playing herself?
Yeah, she's playing herself as a kind of parody of herself, and they very much take the piss out of her. And so, for instance, Jane Fonda like accuses her of having daddy issues, and they're all like, no, why can't she just be alone? And they organise for her to have an intervention from her friends who, and this is where the sex addict thing comes in, and they're like, we think you might be a sex addict. You've got to be a lot on your own. And she gets really annoyed at them in a very funny way. I must say the film is actually quite good and it's quite funny.
Okay.
The jokes land. There's one point where she's in the rain and someone's like one of her friends goes, I bet she thinks this is a sign.
Do you mind me asking the really obvious question that I probably should know the answer to given our special last week? What's the point of it? That's what I still can't seem to get to the bottom of. Why has this film been made and released?
Honestly, Cathers, I couldn't tell you. What I will say is it's much better than the album.
Is it? Is it like a musical film? Like, is each song on the album done as a musical number throughout the album?
Yes.
So it's like it very much is.
It's a companion.
As it was built, a companion piece to the album.
So it opens with her working as a kind of engineer on some giant mechanical heart that's broken down. It's stopped producing rose petals, so they've got to fix it.
And I'm definitely going to watch it because I've seen all of J-Lo's films, so it would be rude to miss this one.
I mean, it's quite fun, and you know, watching her singing and dancing whilst also there being an actual narrative is quite fun. The therapy sessions are particularly good. And actually, she says something that made me feel bad about how much I mocked her for her obsession with falling in love. She says to her therapist, I know what they say about hopeless romantics, that they're weak, but I'm not weak. It takes strength to keep believing in something after you keep falling flat on your face.
Aww, and I was like, that's really cute and sad.
That's actually fair.
Yeah. And good for her, actually.
Good for J-Lo.
What a spirit.
I know. It's actually really lovely that she keeps believing in love.
It is. She is just the queen of the rom-com.
She is. However, listen, the album is shit, I must say.
Oh no. Do you think even I'll think it's shit?
Yes. Some of the lyrics are making me absolutely die. So in To Be Yours, she goes, it's like heaven times 1,000. Heaven times 1,000.
Oh, funny. God, we're doing a lot of singing recently. Sorry, guys.
I know. And then she goes, in Mad and Love, she goes, yeah, we stunting, getting rich off love, to the bank we running. And then on Dear Ben Part 2, sitting here alone, looking at my ring ring, feeling overwhelmed, makes me want to sing sing.
So is Ben in it? Where does Ben figure in this epic tale of love?
So he's a writer on This Is Me Now, the film, but the credit has disappeared.
The direction credit you actually mentioned last week.
Yes. So it was directed by Dave Meyers, who's done like a lot of like Harry Styles videos. So I was wrong. It's not directed, but he did co-write it. But weirdly, so it's on Wikipedia as he co-wrote it, but it's not on IMDb. The credit seems to have mysteriously
gone.
Right.
So does he actually appear in it? Is he in the film?
Through various lookalikes, yes.
Okay, so he himself does not play himself. There isn't a happily ever after moment at the end.
I do think
where she gets her man.
There's a scene where she's driving along the sand on a motorbike. I do think that might actually be Ben driving the motorbike because they look so similar. But yeah, there's loads of Ben lookalikes.
But you blink and you miss him.
Yeah. Also, Jane Fonda, quite an icon. She was so sassy. She says she's done another film. So there's now a documentary to accompany the film and the album.
From Jennifer.
Yes. And Jane Fonda stars in it. And she says, there's a bit where she's talking to J-Lo and she says, this is my concern. It feels too much like you're trying to prove something instead of just living it. You know,
and that was in the documentary. So.
Yeah. You know, every other photograph is the two of you kissing and the two of you hugging. So essentially kind of shaming the XSPDA. Yeah.
Tell me how it is.
I know. I love it. I mean, yes.
I love Jane Fonda. I don't really know anything about her, like in terms of beyond the actual film she's been in, but she just...
And her exercise videos.
Just major vibes.
Major
she?
Vibes. And looks fantastic. I also would like to end this J-Lo
report
by telling you two diva demands. I happened to be reading a piece and these two little tidbits about her diva demands came up. So I thought, considering last week's episode, I will fill you in.
Please do.
So an infamous appearance on the BBC in 2001 only happened after the corporation accommodated her request for 9 separate dressing rooms for her entourage of 90 people.
Wow.
She reportedly requested a 45-foot trailer for the filming of a cameo in a charity video for victims of AIDS and 9/11. She's also believed to have, in her prime, demanded all white dressing rooms stocked with silk curtains, scented candles and white lilies. The New York Post has also claimed that it was Benny Medina who saddled Lopez with her diva image, and it was him that orchestrated all of Lopez's extravagant riders. And in fact, it became so bad that Lopez's talent agency Endeavor refused to work with her if Medina remained, and that's why she fired him.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is something I've heard a lot, actually, particularly in the music industry, is people's mad riders will often be the manager, just like putting stuff
charting
for him.
It. Yeah. They'll be like, right, let's just chuck a 5 pairs of boxers on there and some t-shirts.
Exactly.
And 6 bottles of Merlot and
just
things
stuff
that they
you might
just
need.
Plan on taking.
Yeah.
But the thing that I always found really interesting about riders when I first started interviewing musicians specifically about them was that they have to pay for it out of their own fee anyway. It's not free.
Oh.
Yeah, so your rider comes out of your fee. So you're paying for all that stuff. So it makes a lot of sense that manipulative managers would try and get things in there, because it's just another classic case of them.
So I always thought it was the venue that paid for it.
No, it comes out of the fee. So you can request the high heels all you want. I remember once that really randomly, Dua Lipa, her GQ shoot, had requested Pez's. You know Pez, like those little sweets you get in Europe?
Oh,
where it's like
yeah.
a cartoon with a plastic head.
Yeah.
Really random stuff like that.
And Mariah Carey's White Kittens.
And all the same colour M&Ms. But they're all those urban myths that you can't believe are possibly true.
The M&Ms, I'm sure we've said this in our Behind the Music mini-series, but is actually a really smart ploy. I think it was a rock band that did it, but basically they asked for M&Ms but no brown ones. And they would know by looking at whether the venue had properly sorted through the M&Ms that their sound check would go well. And if they were still brown M&Ms in the pot, they wouldn't even bother doing the sound check, because they were like, things are going to go wrong. Like, we are not in safe hands, essentially.
Ooh.
Yeah, so it was a good way of weeding out incompetence.
I would like to finish on a fascinating piece that ran in The Cut last week, which I think feels especially relevant given that London Fashion Week wrapped only 2 years ago. So The Cut piece that's gone viral is by the model Paloma El Sessa. It's called The Price of Being First. The kind of stand first is, I made modelling history, then the internet made me wish I hadn't. It's such an important read. I think it really speaks to the insanity of online culture and criticism. And it's kind of about trolling. Actually, she encapsulates that exact like double-edged swordness of being in the public eye and how you might be celebrated in your industry, but then comes with it so much scrutiny and hate.
Yes.
So if you don't know about Paloma El Sessa, she is considered a kind of body positivity pioneer. So, and I'm quoting a Vogue headline here. She was the first curve woman to win Model of the Year at the Fashion Awards 2023.
Oh,
so by all metrics, you would think that that is a most incredible achievement. However, she starts the piece with saying that she's there on her hands and knees at the Sunset Tower Hotel praying, saying, please, God, please don't let me this ward. I simply do not have the capacity, which seems deeply ironic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you would think that being recognised in your field like that is like the pinnacle for anyone.
When she, capacity for what? Mentally?
Yeah, so she kind of explains how she was discovered. She was actually found by Pat McGrath, you know, the iconic
yes.
makeup artist. She had been studying psychology and literature, and she was only 22, and her whole life kind of changed in the 9 years since then. She's been on the covers of American British Vogue. She's done runways. She's released a book. But she says, and I quote, yet amid these milestones, I have been afraid of feeling found out. Constantly self-editing, trying to find my balance between tender self-acceptance and unbridled self-hatred. Each victory for representation comes with a new flood of vitriol and a new wave of doubt. Maybe they're right. Maybe I don't deserve to be here at all.
Oh, God.
I know. So she said that she did anticipate the backlash that the award would unleash. So again, I quote her, oh, this fat girl doesn't deserve to win, or inclusivity is ruining fashion. But that night, winning was not on my radar. I genuinely believed it wasn't going to happen. So she hadn't prepped a speech or anything. She talks about how she and the other models that were all up for the award, so the nominees, all represent what it means to persevere in an industry that doesn't center you. So none of them are white, none of them are children of the famous parents, all of us working our asses off. She felt very honored and all of that. So she says that the reality hit her the next morning when she was on her way to the airport. The hate had scrawled across thousands of comments on TikTok, Instagram and X, tearing apart my body, my face, my walk. People were having full-blown conversations in the comments sections of my own posts.
Oh my God.
Yeah. comments like, she's a diversity pick and real models work so hard to have the bodies that they have. You get to just sit around eating cheeseburgers flooded my phone, and the onslaught of negativity didn't just come from faceless trolls. In a TikTok that was like 219,000 times, Kanye West fueled the fire, alleging I was part of a vast conspiracy to push obesity on us.
Oh my God, yes, I saw that.
This narrative has long followed me and many in the public eye whose bodies aren't thin. Yet over the last few years, fat phobia has become acceptable again. Representation in the media has become less alluring to folks, and its purpose being reduced to woke ideology. I mean, I think that's so true. There is so much lip service towards diversity in industries like media and fashion.
Yes, but the reality is there are still very few plus size models walking the wrong way.
Exactly. And this is really what Paloma gets at. So again, she writes, I'm protective of the fashion industry, but it's become evident that many of the same people who talk about making these huge strides in representation are also painfully resistant to change. And what about my role in their narrative? The industry may carve out name for a select few names like mine, but it firmly shuts the door on countless others. The pride in being part of a list of firsts is fading. Being the first curve model for a campaign loses its significance when the brand fails to open its doors for the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. Which I found fascinating because I think that's so true, especially at the moment in terms of the fat phobia that she's addressing with the rise of Ozempic.
Yeah.
There's lip service to having models with different sized bodies on catwalks. And yes, London Fashion Week has been doing some of that, some of the designers showing there, but it feels very hollow, doesn't it? When
it does.
Most major celebrities now walking around like sticks.
Christ, yeah.
One paragraph that really made me feel so sad, and I think really speaks to the insanity of online discourse, was when she says, it felt as though my intrusive thoughts had become the subject of discourse for every rando on the internet. Zero posts, zero followers, with handles like Fashion Lover 2002. Are these people not aware that I too think I'm fat, ugly, short, and a bad model sometimes? She says she shut off her public social media accounts for the past 2 months. So the awards were in December. I guess she's been offline since. And she says, it's painful to admit, but I found myself believing that I didn't deserve to have almost a decade of hard work acknowledged.
Like, there's actually a new podcast, I don't know who it's made by, that's all about Daily Mail comments. And
I've seen that in the comments.
Yeah, yes, that's it. But I am fascinated by the psychology behind these people that leave horrendous comments on people's public profiles. Obviously, comments have been around forever, but I do think, tying into the whole main character syndrome that we constantly talk about, people try and flex in the comments. Like, people try and like go off in the comments to get as many likes as possible. To like, the comment section has become its own horrible
ecosystem.
Yeah, of like people trying to get attention and what want it. It's like men always say on the male, all male WhatsApp chat, like it leads them to say awful stuff because they're always trying to have the last word.
Yeah.
And then they end up saying stuff, horrendous stuff they don't mean.
Actually, you're so right. Since you've said to me a couple of years ago that the comments section is kind of your favorite place, I've been lurking in the comments way more on posts.
It's fascinating.
And even the other day, I don't know if you know who Naomi Smart is, but she's a well-known YouTuber influencer.
Yes, I do. Yeah,
I think she was one of the kind of OGs. The reason that she went onto my radar is because she went out with this guy for a while that I used to know, who's like a fitness influencer, and we'd done some stuff with him at GQ. Anyway, all of this is a long-winded way to say that I started following her, and in the last year she got engaged, and subsequently, turns out, as she announced in a piece on self-love for Hello Magazine for Valentine's Day, the engagement hasn't worked out. So sleuths have noticed that on her profile, she's deleted all the posts of this guy, of the engagement. But in the comments section of her own posts recently, her followers are literally discussing her relationship status with one another over like hundreds of interlinked comments being like, yep, have you not seen? She's deleted all the posts of him. Ooh, I thought he was weird and culty anyway. Like, really critical of her, of him, of her life choices. Well, second broken engagement kind of says there's something wrong with her, doesn't it? The audacity to do that under one of her own pictures. Like, at least go on bloody Tattle Life and be a bitch fucking anonymously.
Yeah, I do also think that people like to leave incredibly horrible, provocative comments because they know that celebrities will often reply to them. Like, Maya Jama will often reply to her worst troll. She did that last week, actually.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I like her humour when she does it, but also you are giving them oxygen and attention. Sometimes it humbles them and they're so embarrassed and they delete their profile. But some people will then be encouraged to leave comments because they hope that Maya Jama will reply to them and they'll get their like 1 second of fame.
I mean, I found it quite mad the other day, post Maya and Stormzy's really cute couples TikTok. I'm living
obsessed
for their couples content at the moment. Like,
also, she looked great.
She looks so great. And they just look so happy and so in love, and their little South African Valentine's extravaganza.
Oh, so you think the Valentine's was in South Africa?
I thought so. That's what I got from it, that he'd flown out.
No, because she's come back. She was at London Fashion Week.
Oh, well, I don't know. They were in a hotel somewhere. God knows.
No, but... I think she's come back, but I was desperately trying to figure out what he did for Valentine's Day.
He got her a Birkin.
Yes, a mini Birkin. One thing I'm really noticing over the last year, but maybe it's been older, is what guys now comment, particularly on women's posts like Maya's, is she's mid. Oh, she's just mid.
Because they're trying to tear her down.
That's like their like go-to and sort of choice now.
So fucking pathetic. Can't deal.
Honestly, Maya Jama being mid, hilarious.
It's like with Paloma El Sessa, people criticising what she looks like when she's literally one of the biggest models in the world, objectively stunning, has fronted the most incredible campaigns, and they've got the audacity to say that she doesn't deserve it. What the fuck do they know?
What? I would love to see what kind of lives these people lead. They're probably really normal. They're probably quite like, it would probably stun us to see how normal they are in their daily lives. It's also made me think of this piece. I can't remember where it was. I have to put it in the show notes, but it was all about how, like, particularly with food and health bloggers, the comments are not so much trolling, but so self-involved. And they'll comment being like, but what if I'm dairy intolerant? Okay, but what if I can't eat this? But what if, but I can't, but I have this really
cheese-based recipe. It's so like, maybe don't make it.
Don't make it, or go and find someone that does do a dairy, glucose, wheat and free, whatever it is. And it's this, and the piece was talking about how, like, there's always got to be a problem with something. Somehow you're always leaving someone out. And it's like, on something as mundane as a, I don't know, bloody...
I do see that, though. That food actually, blogger. Like, totally rings true to me. Just in terms of even, like, yeah, recipe content creators will have people being like, I can't eat mushrooms. What shall I switch them for? And they expect, like, a personalised recipe edit.
Exactly. Just go and find something else.
Funny.
And again, I do think it's the sense of main character syndrome. But I do think because of Twitter and all these, people now feel like their opinion matters is the issue. People now think that what they have to say could be really important. We've all got way too inflated, like, estimation of our own opinion at the moment.
Well, that's what they say about the internet, right? It's been this great leveler because on your Instagram feed even, the celebrity sits next to the person that you used to go to school with, and your brain can't really compute the difference.
So true. Actually, I read a really good piece by Helen Lewis on her Substack, The Blue Stocking, and she was talking about the problem with opinion journalism and how we've actually lost the art of properly reviewing culture, like technically in terms of like the art, and we're still so focused instead of our opinion on something to do with the politics.
Yeah.
Which obviously is essential, don't get me wrong, but we do seem to have lost the balance, maybe.
I will give that a read. I would like to end on one final thought from poor old Paloma El Sessa.
Poor old Paloma.
Well, I really shouldn't say poor old because... No. I think you can't not read this piece and feel empathy for people that are labelled the first. It's definitely a blessing and a curse. What really stuck with me was what she said after the bit that I read out earlier about her feeling that she didn't deserve to have her hard work acknowledged. She said, I'm left wondering what the point is of trying to shape a world where acceptance and critical thinking are possible, only to be plunged into the depths of self-loathing. What is the point if you still end up in the same place, entangled in a misery we all know too well? Still, I can't help but feel that if I hide away, fat phobia will win and so many potential gains will further fade into distance. I just think that's such a valid point.
Yes, that's a very good point.
It's so hard for the people that are out there being the kind of trailblazers.
Yeah, and I guess even though obviously it's amazing for her to constantly be advocating plus size women, you kind of just want to be a model.
Yeah, and it takes a huge toll on her own mental health and self-worth. Yeah.
Yes, I always do think actually that being a role model is a very, very difficult job in the age of social media and not to be underestimated.
Yeah.
I think Stormzy said that before as well, actually.
Well, yeah, that's why he called his second album Heavy as the Head, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. That's enough of us talking in your little ears.
It is quite enough for one day. We love hearing from you, as always. Please do shoot us some DMs. We are finally recording the mythical
unicorn
kids question episode next week. So final thoughts on fertility, on having kids, pros, cons. We are open to receive.
DM us.
You can email. We love hearing from you. I think I already said that.
We love
recording for too long.
Sorry. The email is hello@straightuppodcast.co.uk for those that don't have it. Please leave us a review on Apple and Spotify.
That would be amazing. We'll love you forever and ever and ever and ever.
And do send this episode to a friend who might like to join our community. Yay.